This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Republicans will now control the House and the Senate for the first time in 40 years. And that means President Clinton's legislative agenda will face tough opposition. At his press conference this afternoon, the president said that he would do everything in his power to reach out to the leaders and members of this new Congress. My guest, Elizabeth Drew, has spent the past few years investigating what's happened behind the scenes at the Clinton White House. Drew is the author of the new book, On the Edge, The Clinton Presidency. She's been writing about Washington politics since the 1960s. She wrote for The New Yorker for about 20 years and frequently appears on Meet the Press. I asked her if she thinks the Clinton administration has new priorities and strategies in place to face the new Congress.
I don't know that the plan would be any different than what it was going to be before they knew the exact outcome. Because you see, Terry, there was no way that Clinton was going to come out of this election with a working majority in either the House or the Senate. He barely had it in his first 2 years. You remember in the book all these very, very close shaves and hard-fought battles to win his legislative victories. And they already knew that it was going to be a lot harder after the elections. And in some ways, some of the people around him thought that it wasn't an altogether bad thing for him to lose the Senate, because then he would have something to point to as a reason he wasn't getting anything more done, as opposed to having a Democratic Congress, ostensibly Democratic Congress, but not getting more done. So I don't think the plan necessarily changes. It's to come up with a far more modified health care proposal. It's to pursue welfare reform. It's to do a little bit more on deficit reduction growing out of the of a Kerry commission that was set up. And it was already thought that he wasn't going to do that much legislatively. You know, there was a lot of criticism, and I must say I thought it too, in the early months of the Clinton administration, that he was taking on too much. He had his reasons, and he was right. The major power of a president is in his first, I would say, 18 months. This is the period that I covered. And the power always dissipates after that. You're into the presidential election after the first two sessions of Congress. So they were right to try to get a lot done during that period, and they did get a lot done. Oddly, the public doesn't understand that, which we could come back to. The other thing that they're planning to do in this next period, they keep saying they're going to do it, but I think they're more serious now, is have Clinton make more use of the bully pulpit. He's very good, almost at his best, when he talks about the urban problems and the problem of children killing children. And he could really lead a national effort in this respect, and I think they're going to try. And the other thing that they have talked about doing is spending more time demonstrating the implementation of the programs that have been passed, partly because people don't know they've been passed, and partly because they don't have any sense of the impact on their communities and their lives. So I think the emphasis is going to be in those directions, not always on legislation.
Well, you write in your new book that President Clinton knew early on that losing control of the Congress was a real possibility, so he tried to get as much legislation passed early on as possible. How effective do you think he was at that?
He was very effective. He got a great deal done. Some things that people do know about, obviously the deficit reduction, the getting the NAFTA treaty with Mexico passed, and he was able to shift some of the spending priorities toward the domestic programs that he called investments. It was actually more spending for such things as Head Start, education, and so on. Now, I think the Republican Congress will probably put a stop to that.
I know that you share the widely held view that yesterday's election was really a referendum on Clinton, and the voting in of Republicans is a rejection of Clinton. you think Clinton was reasonably effective in getting legislation passed. What do you think hurt him most?
I think it's a combination of things, as I lay out in the book, and that is he and Mrs. Clinton were astonishingly unprepared to govern. When I say astonishingly, it's because they both are very, very smart people. They both had been in and out of Washington a lot in the course of their adult lives, working on national issues. They both had access to networks of people who would have helped them. But they really felt that they could do this on their own. They had a surprising antipathy to Washington, which many people may find understandable, but it's a little surprising in them since they really had so many bases here. Anyway, they felt that they could handle this. They deliberately, in choosing the White House staff, did not go for experience. They went for people who didn't have any independent standing and weren't Washington figures. Later on, the president's close aide, Bruce Lindsay, said, well, we went too far. But their idea was, we want to change things, and anybody who's in Washington ipso facto is against change, which was a silly overgeneralization. So having picked this inexperienced staff and doing it only 6 days before the inauguration, they started making mistakes right away. He had to drop his attorney general nominee on day one of his presidency. By day three or four, he was in an open fight with the Joint Chiefs of Staff and Sam Nunn on the policy of not allowing gays to serve in the military. This said to people, this man who had run and tried to define himself as a centrist was over on the left. I know people still bring that up about gays in the military. The other things are, though he did accomplish things, he just didn't get it across. I lay some percentage of that to, a high percentage of that to Clinton and his aides. Another probably equal proportion to the press, which is not interested in those stories as much as they are in conflict and problems. And there were just a number of, because of the inexperience, there were a number of pratfalls. Such as the haircut on the runway in Los Angeles, such as the handling of the travel office, even something seemingly minor as the, in the great scheme of things, as a White House aide taking a couple of helicopters to play golf. All of these things eroded Clinton's political strength, eroded confidence in him, and got in the way of, distracted the White House people from their jobs and distracted the public from what he was getting done.
During Clinton's campaign, the, quote, character problem was something that was perceived as working against him. Do you think that followed him into his presidency?
I definitely think it followed him into his presidency, and it intensified. People elected him in 92 with a not very large plurality, 43%, with some misgivings about his character. This embraced several things. One is his personal past and the Jennifer Flowers episode, and one was Whitewater was kind of there, but it didn't. A lot of attention wasn't paid to it, and some of it was what's known as the Slick Willie phenomenon. The I didn't inhale, being a little too cute by half. So he was elected with misgivings, and then what happens is you get into the White House, and the focus is so much more intense. I mean, nobody is really prepared for that. And the remarks are so much more scrutinized, and you hear so much more from him. So that all those things became intensified. And though his aides, when various scandals broke, like the Arkansas troopers alleging that Clinton had, as governor, had used them to arrange alleged multiple assignations, more Whitewater. His aides say, oh, all that was covered in the campaign. The American people have made up their minds on that. It's a closed subject, but it's not. And every reminder of that, as these same aides perfectly know, erodes Clinton's authority and effectiveness. And they really live in fear of more shoes dropping. And connected with that was an erosion of the moral authority of the Oval Office. I think that's Clinton's most serious problem. He wanted to be one of the people, which is fine, but just up to a point. The American people also want dignity and majesty in that Oval Office. And Clinton, in a way, was too much with us. He talked too much. He was too accessible. His aides tried desperately to get him to wear tracksuits when he jogged, because those shorts aren't marvelous to behold, to not make policy pronouncements when he's just finished jogging all sweaty and in that baseball cap. Having allowed that aura of the Oval Office to slip away, I think Clinton has been far more vulnerable because he doesn't get the presumptions that people usually attribute to a president. And I don't know if he can get it back. I think that's the hardest thing he has to do.
Journalist Elizabeth Drew is my guest. She's the author of a new book about the Clinton presidency called On the Edge. We'll be back after a break. This is Fresh Air. We're talking about the election and the Clinton presidency with journalist Elizabeth Drew. President Clinton will now be working with a Republican-controlled Congress. You write about some interesting problems he had early on in getting votes. You say that he didn't really know how to ask for a vote.
Well, that's true. There was a lot of on-the-job learning here. And early on, he would make phone calls and say, well, I certainly hope you'll be with us. But he didn't really ask for a vote, and he didn't really nail anything down. But Clinton is a learner and a grower.
So do you think he learned how to do it?
He definitely learned how to do it. Now,
is he good at it now?
He's good at it, but there arose another problem. A member of Congress, a Democratic House member of some real importance, said to me, you know, he's too accessible to us. In other words, he was so accessible, and it became so easy, really, to get something from him in exchange for a vote, that it became the normal thing to hold out the vote until he gave something away. In exchange for it. This led to a picture of a president who could be rolled, of inconsistency on certain issues. So he paid a price for his accessibility to and his willingness to trade.
No, he passed the crime bill with the help of moderates from both parties. Will there be fewer moderates left in the Democrats and the Republicans in the House and Senate?
Well, there will, and I think this is one of the most important results of the elections, that the Republican caucus in both the House and the Senate will be more to the right, and the Democratic caucuses in the House and the Senate will be more to the left. I think this is going to be a very polarized situation, despite all the talk today about how cooperative everybody's going to be. They're not. I mean, once in a while they will if they see that it's in their interest to try to work together. But I'm actually quite concerned about what I see as an intensively polarized situation. And my real doubt that in that kind of situation and leading into a presidential election very much will get accomplished. And if what the people are saying is, we want change out of Washington, we want things to be different, and they weren't, so we're going to, upset the tables here and elect Republicans, and they still don't get things, they still don't feel that things have been done, I sort of fear for what the public mood will be after that.
What do you see now as being at the top of President Clinton's agenda and at the top of the Republican congressional agenda?
Well, Clinton will go for the welfare reform bill because that's always been identified as a centrist Democratic issue. And his aides have always found that when he talks about it, people like that. You know, when he gives speeches, they have people pressing buttons to give their response to each little thing. And every time he talked about welfare reform, he got a positive response. So he talked about welfare reform in a lot of speeches, even though they didn't have a plan. They finally came up with a plan, and I think it's going to be more of a battle than it might have been, because the Republicans will undoubtedly want more of a more punitive plan than Clinton will. But that would certainly be one of them, and it gives him a chance to try to get back to the center. There will be other things, as I mentioned. They will come back for a modified health care plan. The Republicans, I think, are in for a much more difficult time than people are suggesting right now. There are going to be divisions among them, and Bob Dole and Newt Gingrich really don't see eye to eye on substance, and they are temperamentally different. And so their position is not going to be an easy one, and they will be constantly sort of examining whether they should be out-and-out opponents or they're seen as too negative and they should try to cooperate. There will be differences in approach between Dole and Gingrich. There will be differences among the other Republicans. So they're not in for a picnic either. And in some ways, it's, you know, the worst thing for Clinton would have been to have non-working but apparent majorities in each chamber.
What are the major differences politically and stylistically between Dole and Gingrich?
Well, basically, Dole has been more of a Midwestern, slightly conservative, moderate, governing Republican. Gingrich is much more of a bomb thrower. He's much more ideological. He's much more likely to pop off with things that might be of an embarrassment. For instance, last weekend, blaming this Susan Smith tragedy of the two killed children on the Democrats. I think there are going to be a lot of times when Gingrich, who is extremely smart and extremely interesting, I mean, this is going to be great fun to watch, but that he will embarrass the Republicans from time to time.
Now, what are the differences between Dole and Gingrich's political priorities now?
I don't think Dole subscribes to the Contract for America that Gingrich put out, in that Dole is a much more cautious on fiscal issues. He's more of a traditional Republican. He feels that the numbers have to add up. He's more responsible on those issues, and so will be the budget chairman, Mr. Pete Domenici, than the Republicans in the House will be. In the end, though, there are rules about these things. You can't just go out there and pass things that don't add up. But I think there will be a constant struggle between the House and Senate Republicans, as well as within the parties.
The Contract for America that you referred to, that Gingrich drew up, calls for tax cuts, a balanced budget amendment, term limits.
Yes, and it doesn't add up, and Dole knows that. And the question is how they can, you know, how far they can go in even trying to do this.
Now, how does President Clinton get along with Dole and Gingrich?
Not very well. I think it's been a testy relationship all along. And, you know, when you have Newt Gingrich telling some lobbyists before the election that he really wants a Republican takeover in the House so that they can have a full committee that investigates corruption in the administration, this doesn't make Clinton feel very warm and cozy toward Gingrich. On Dole, it's been testy. They've sometimes been able to work together, but basically not, because Dole really hasn't been a free man all this time. His own Senate caucus, the Republicans are more conservative, of a more conservative and bomb thrower bent than he is. So it's going to be dicey.
As Democrats have been pointing out, the Republicans, now that they're in the majority in Congress, will have more of the responsibility to govern. Do you think that that's going to change anything about the behavior of Republicans within Congress?
I think it is going to cause more difficulty for them, because now they do have to be accountable. And I think that they're going to be wandering around a little bit, deciding how much they really have to be governing Republicans versus opposition to the administration Republicans.
The last sentence of your new book about the Clinton presidency reads, "The president has to redefine what his presidency is about." That's a quote from one of Clinton's advisors, and the advisor said that to you at the end of August. How do you think the president has been or will continue to redefine what his presidency is about?
Well, what struck me was how often I heard White House aides say that about Clinton. They had said it at least a year earlier when he went off for vacation with all sorts of problems. And the big saying around the White House in August of 93 was that he has to redefine his presidency. He has to come back more toward the center. He has to give a kind of overarching theme to what it is that he has been trying to do. And here, a year later, another aide is saying the same thing. And I was quite struck by that. I don't think he has had a lot of success yet at doing that. But he's going to have to, especially in the new situation he finds himself in.
Elizabeth Drew, she's the author of a new book called On the Edge, The Clinton Presidency. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.